to Quebec. This is intended for all Quebecers. We must take extreme measures to curb the pandemic. Only essential services remain open. Gatherings are prohibited. It's forbidden to leave your home between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. These efforts aim to protect our healthcare workers, seniors, and loved ones. Let's comply with the lockdown and curfew to lower the risk of contracting COVID-19, because our health is important. For more information, visit quebec.ca/confinement. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
What is happening right now is not the end of the affair, but it might just be the beginning of the move of the far right to try to catapult itself to power.
As House Democrats move to impeach President Trump for inciting a violent insurrection, the FBI is warning of armed right-wing protests at all 50 state capitals this weekend. We'll speak to Filipino scholar Walden Bella, author of Counter-Revolution, The Global Rise of the Far Right, his latest piece, America Has Entered the Weimar Era. Then we look at President Trump's race to execute more prisoners before his term ends in an unprecedented lame duck killing spree.
I think it's the callous brute force of the mentality of the Trump administration that he just believes that he can use force and kill people. He can use violence and force to make his point. There's no need for these executions to happen.
On Monday, a federal judge granted a stay of execution for Lisa Montgomery, who is set to become the first woman executed by the federal government in almost 70 years. But the Trump administration is appealing the decision. Two men are also scheduled to be executed this week. We'll speak with longtime death penalty critic Sister Helen Prejean. Stay with us. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. House Democrats are inching toward removing President Trump from power after he incited his supporters to attack the U.S. Capitol last Wednesday. On Monday, the House adjourned for the day after Republicans objected to a voice vote on a measure calling on Vice President Mike Pence to invoke the 25th Amendment. The House is set to vote on that measure today. Pence has signaled he's unlikely to declare Trump incapable of executing his duties, and such a move would also require a majority of Trump's cabinet members. Democratic leaders have scheduled an impeachment vote for Wednesday. More than 218 lawmakers have already committed to passage of the single article of impeachment, charging Trump with inciting violence against the government of the United States. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell has adjourned the Senate until January 19th, all but ruling out a Senate impeachment trial ahead of Joe Biden's inauguration January 20th. Biden on Monday questioned whether the Senate could bifurcate its business during his first 100 days, suggesting senators could hold off on an impeachment trial in order to get cabinet members confirmed. Meanwhile, at least 47 lawmakers are co-sponsoring a resolution by freshman Missouri Democrat Congressmember Cori Bush, calling for the removal of Republicans who encouraged last week's insurrection at the Capitol. The FBI's warning armed protests are being planned in all 50 state capitals and in Washington, D.C., before and during Joe Biden's inauguration next week. In Michigan, authorities have banned the open carry of firearms inside the state capitol building, hoping to avoid a repeat of last April when heavily armed militia members menaced lawmakers during a vote to extend public health measures during the pandemic. In Washington, D.C., Pentagon officials say up to 15,000 National Guard members could be deployed to protect against a replay of last week's insurrection. Washington Mayor Muriel Bowser is calling on the Department of Homeland Homeland Security and other federal agencies to dramatically increase security for the inauguration, but says the event should remain public. President-elect Biden said Monday he will take the oath of office publicly. This comes as the Washington Post reports that during Wednesday's insurrection, Republican leaders tried repeatedly and failed to get Trump to call off the mob he incited. Trump reportedly could not be reached because he was too busy watching the crisis unfold on live television for hours. Connecticut Democratic Senator Chris Murphy said Monday Trump is continuing to thwart attempts to secure the January 20th inauguration.
President Trump is still in charge, and part of the reason why Congress is talking about impeachment right now is because he is not being helpful in trying to guarantee the security of the inauguration. In fact, he seems to be doing more harm than good.
Washington, D.C.'s attorney general said Monday he's considering riot incitement charges against President Trump Jr., against Donald Trump Jr., as well as his attorney Rudy Giuliani and Republican Congressmember Mo Brooks for inciting Trump's mob to violence. He's considering charges against the president. On Monday, acting Homeland Security Secretary Chad Wolf resigned, becoming the third cabinet secretary to quit since Trump's mob attacked Congress last week. In his resignation letter, Wolf did not refer directly to the Capitol Hill assault. Instead, he said he was quitting because of legal challenges to his authority to run DHS without Senate confirmation. Authorities are still looking for those responsible for planting pipe bombs outside the Republican and Democratic National Committee headquarters last Wednesday and for fatally wounding Capitol Police Officer Brian Sicknick, who was struck in the head by a fire extinguisher. The U.S. Army is investigating an active-duty PSYOPs officer who led a contingent of insurrectionists to Washington, D.C. last week. Captain Emily Rainey of the 4th Psychological Operations Group says she led 100 members of a conservative group to D.C. to, quote, stand against election fraud. Meanwhile, the Capitol Police Department has suspended two officers for their involvement with or support for last week's insurrection, among them an officer who put on a red MAGA hat and directed rioters around the Capitol, and another who posed for selfies with insurrectionists. More than a dozen officers are under investigation. The United States recorded 223,000 coronavirus cases Monday and more than 2,000 deaths. The U.S. has averaged more than 3,000 COVID-19 deaths per day over the past week and could pass 400,000 deaths before President-elect Joe Biden sworn in January 20th. Arizona remains the worst-affected state, but Republican Governor Doug Ducey continues to refuse to issue a statewide mask mandate. On Monday, hundreds of teachers in Arizona's Peoria Unified School District staged a massive sick-out to protest unsafe classrooms. This comes as many bars and restaurants across Arizona remain open for indoor dining. Meanwhile, gorillas at the San Diego Zoo in California have tested positive for coronavirus, showing mild symptoms. Zookeepers say it's the first known instance of natural transmission of the virus to great apes. At least two members of Congress have contracted COVID-19 after Wednesday's insurrection. Democrat Bonnie Watson Coleman of New Jersey, a 75-year-old cancer survivor, believes she was exposed during protective isolation as Trump supporters rampaged through the Capitol. Video shows several Republican lawmakers in the cramped isolation space refusing to wear face masks. Also testing positive, Congressmember Pramila Jayapal, who's been quarantining at home since the riots. Jayapal said any lawmaker who refuses to wear a mask should be fined and removed by the House Sergeant at Arms. Six lawmakers, all of them Republicans, previously tested positive since the 118th Congress was sworn in on January 3rd. Most lawmakers have received a single dose of the Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine, but have not yet received their second shot, which confers better protection against the disease. In Delaware, President-elect Joe Biden received his second shot of the two-dose Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine Monday. Pfizer said it expects to boost output of its vaccine to 2 billion doses this year amid surging demand. The U.S. has secured contracts for 200 million of those doses, with another 600 million promised to the European Union. In Geneva, World Health Organization officials warned Monday it's unlikely most countries will reach herd immunity through vaccination in 2021. WHO advisor Bruce Aylward called on wealthy countries and drug companies to do more to provide vaccines to the world's poorer nations.
Over 40 countries have now begun vaccinating against COVID-19 using 5 different COVID vaccines. However, all of that vaccination, or virtually all of it, as the Director General has emphasized, were in the high-income and upper-middle-income countries so far.
Coronavirus cases continue to surge in southern Africa. Zimbabwe officials have banned traditional funerals amidst a spike in COVID-19 linked to funeral rites. In Johannesburg, South Africa, a government-run hospital has moved COVID-19 patients into a parking lot after all available beds filled to capacity. In Lebanon, officials have ordered an 11-day, 24-hour curfew beginning Thursday. The order sparked panic buying at grocery stores, with fears crowded markets will lead to further community spread. Meanwhile, the Portuguese president, Marcelo Rebelo de Sousa, announced Monday he tested positive for coronavirus and is isolating his official residence in Lisbon without symptoms. Portugal currently has one of the highest infection rates in Europe, with nearly 8,000 deaths since the start of the pandemic. The Trump administration's placed Cuba back on a list of state sponsors of terrorism, reversing an Obama-era decision to remove the label over 5 years ago. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo Monday accused Cuba of granting safe harbor to terrorists and attacked the country's support for Venezuela. The Cuban foreign minister, Bruno Rodriguez, condemned the move as hypocritical and cynical. On Twitter, he said, quote, "The U.S. political opportunism of this action is recognized by anyone with an honest regard for the scourge of terrorism and its victims," he said. Yesterday marked 19 years since former President George W. Bush sent the first post-9/11 prisoners to the U.S. naval base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The grim anniversary comes as human rights advocates continue to demand the closure of the U.S. military prison there, where 40 people continue to be indefinitely detained, most without being charged or receiving a fair trial. In a statement, the Center for Constitutional Rights urged the Biden administration to close the prison, saying, quote, "Today marks the beginning of the 20th shameful year of Muslim men being unlawfully imprisoned at Guantanamo. Even in a national landscape of brutal and extreme incarceration, the detentions of the men at Guantanamo are unprecedented and yet largely invisible by now," they said. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has ordered the construction of some 800 homes for Israeli settlers in the West Bank. Palestinian authorities have accused Israel of racing against time to build illegal settlements before President Trump leaves office next week. In 2019, the Trump administration said Israeli settlements in Palestine did not violate international law, despite a 2016 UN resolution declaring them a flagrant violation. This comes as leading Israeli human rights group B'Tselem is denouncing Israel's control of Palestinian territories as a single apartheid regime that violently perpetuates the supremacy of Israelis over Palestinians. In a statement, B'Tselem says, quote, "Israel is not a democracy that has a temporary occupation attached to it. It is one regime between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, and we must look at the full picture and see it for what it is, apartheid," they said. A South Korean court has ordered Japan to compensate women who were forced into sex slavery by Japanese troops during World War II and Japan's colonial rule over South Korea, which started in 1910. The landmark ruling stems from a lawsuit filed in 2016 by a dozen survivors. Japan's argued the two countries settled such claims in a 1965 treaty. Some estimates say up to 200,000 Korean girls and women were forced into sexual slavery by Japanese soldiers. A federal judge granted Lisa Montgomery, the only woman on federal death row, a stay of execution scheduled for this evening. The court ordered a hearing to determine Montgomery's mental competency to face execution. The government's already appealed the ruling. She would become the first woman to face federal execution in nearly 70 years. This comes as four former corrections officers from Indiana have issued a letter urging U.S. Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen to postpone the three federal executions scheduled for this week, citing safety concerns due to COVID-19. The letter, released alongside the American Civil Liberties Union, says executions at Terre Haute have led to a spike in coronavirus cases among prisoners and staff. Two men scheduled for execution later this week, Dustin Higgs and Corey Johnson, recently contracted COVID-19. Later in the broadcast, we'll speak to longtime anti-death penalty activist Sister Helen Prejean. And finally, Colorado's attorney general is opening a grand jury investigation into the police killing of Elijah McClain, a 23-year-old black man from Aurora. McClain was stopped by police as he was walking home in August 2019, tackled, placed in a chokehold, and later injected with ketamine by paramedics. He died days later. And in Bosnia, hundreds of refugees are taking shelter in abandoned buildings as they try to protect themselves from snow and freezing temperatures. This is a 16-year-old refugee from Afghanistan named Ali.
I've been sleeping in the bus for about 5 to 6 months now, and I'm living in really bad conditions. I'm in really a bad way. There's no one to look after us here, and the conditions are not safe. People who are supposed to support us have been coming and taking things from us, and then selling those things inside the camp or in other places. We have nothing here. I have explained what is going on several occasions, and others have talked about what is going on, but no one wants to listen to what we say. I'm asking if you can do anything for us, then please help us.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report.
Welcome back to CKUT. It's time for a little weather. The weather has warmed up this week with periods of snow bringing temperatures around the freezing mark. Wednesday will be mainly cloudy with a high of 0 degrees. Thursday there will be flurries and a high of 2 degrees Celsius. Friday there will be a mix of sun and clouds and a high again of 2 degrees. Saturday shows flurries and a high of 2 degrees Celsius. Sunday will be cloudy with sunny breaks and a high of minus 1 degree Celsius. Monday will be cloudy with sunny breaks and a high of minus 3 degrees. And Tuesday there will be a few flurries and a high of minus 2 degrees. Well, it's time to wrap up the show. Stay safe, be well, and remember to keep curfew hours for the next 4 weeks. Keep listening to CKUT.
take me, hold me, kiss me.
Thank you. My art wears a mask.
My art wears a mask.
My art wears a mask.
This is a special series by Ravel.ca with emerging artists, talking about their challenges and successes during this time of the pandemic.
Hi, and welcome to the final episode of My Art Wears a Mask. I'm Victoria Fenner. A couple of weeks ago, we did an interview with a classical musician who told us how important the online environment is to musicians right now. With live performances canceled, the online world is the only way for them to reach their audiences. Today, we hear from a director of photography in the film world who says that musicians are keeping filmmakers busy. We'll hear from Gabriella Vanden in the second part of today's show. And before that, we take a dive into the world of video gaming. I wanted to include video game designers in this series because, first of all, it's an example of an industry that hasn't been hard hit by the pandemic. With so many people at home, the video gaming industry is booming. At least that's my assumption. My next two guests will tell me if that's an accurate perspective or not. Stephen Riley is a professional game designer, semi-professional writer, and a self-described completely amateur human trying his best to pay rent and make cool stuff. He's originally from Ontario, but is relocated to Halifax. Heather Cleveland is a game designer at HB Studios. She spent 4 years earning her bachelor's in game design at Sheridan College in Ontario. After graduating in the spring of 2020, she packed up her life and moved to Lunenburg, Nova Scotia, and entered the video game industry as it shifted to remote work. She's been working from home since the beginning of the pandemic. An interesting side note, she started her job after the pandemic started, so she's never met some of her colleagues in person because nobody's going to the office. Here's my conversation with Stephen and Heather telling us how the COVID shutdown is affecting them.
We moved to work from home at the end of March, like I think most people did. It was relatively painless. I just went to the studio, grabbed my computer, took it home, and it's on the kitchen counter. So I worked from home for most of the spring. We had no cases for a few weeks, so some of us went back to the studio for a few months in the summer. Because I do prefer working in the studio space where you can just talk to someone face-to-face over, rather than over email or a video call. But when cases started picking up again in October and November, I went back to work from home. But other than just moving my computer one or two times, we've been relatively unaffected by COVID. We've kept working on the project we're working on now, hoping to release next year. And came out of this relatively unscathed, which is a blessing.
I actually moved here in March, just the beginning of the pandemic, from Ontario. And I started working officially in May. And by that point, my studio was already completely remote. So I have always been remote the entire time I've been working there. So it's been really weird working entirely from home. Like I work with people that I wouldn't recognize if I ran to them in the grocery store. It's definitely been an interesting time, but like Stephen said, like for us, like production wise, like we're not really affected by much. Things still go really well. It's not horrible for us. And I'm out of the region, so it's a lot less cases. We're starting to get a few around now, but for the most part, it's been very chill in our area.
So what's it like being in Lunenburg in a smaller community with COVID compared to what you think it might be like in a city like Halifax, for example?
A lot more relaxed, I'll say that. There's a lot more people in the area that don't wear masks and don't really follow restrictions, which is a little spooky, but it's not horrible. You know, for the most part, beyond wearing masks in stores, life's basically unaffected. I still avoid, like, I don't go out and gather with people. But yeah, it's not a huge change for me personally. I'm not somebody who goes out all the time normally, so it's pretty normal for me.
So, and Stephen, what are things like in Halifax right now?
For COVID, we're down to, I think, 10 people indoors, so including staff. So for a lot of bigger stores and businesses, that's like two or three people allowed in at a time. I'm also, I don't know, I'm a bit more aggressive than most people. So when I see someone without a mask, I'll just like, hey, you should put a mask on. People are dying. And, you know, some people take that better than others, but I don't really care. People are dying. Yeah, I've gotten to meet some neighbors that way, so that's been fun. And other than that, I put a mask on when I go out to get groceries and come back. And other than that, I try not to go outside. That's been my life and since like October and then for March to June.
So what is it like, though, to actually work on a game all by yourself in your apartment? Like, I would imagine in the studios where you work, when everybody can get together, there's a lot of sharing of ideas, and there is a lot of... So how does that work? How do you keep your creative momentum when you're working by yourself?
I don't know. For me, I like to have a clean space around me, so I get up a little earlier and like make sure there's no dishes in the sink and everything's folded and looks nice, and then I sit down and listen to a podcast or music and just work away. We have meetings a lot more frequently than we used to. So once a day I meet with my design team, so we're all on the same page. We try to, you know, keep up with each other as just like friends as well and talk about what we've been playing and hang out. And then also make sure all the tasks are being done and assess where everyone's at with their goals. So we divide up our production into 2-week sprints. That is like a set amount of tasks we want done in 2 weeks. And yeah, it's really just sitting down, looking at your tasks and staying on top of things.
So how about with you, Heather? Is it difficult for you not being able to work within a unit that you see every day?
Yeah, it's definitely really strange, especially for me because I've never met most of my coworkers. So, you know, like there's no more small talk and it's really hard, or it's very forced when you do try to have small talk with people. But like there are a lot of pros to it. Like I can sit down and listen to music and work away all day without people constantly asking for my attention. Or I can really focus on ideas and really lay out all my thoughts before I bring them forward to people. And that's really nice. But yeah, I do really miss being in an environment surrounded by people where I can just spitball ideas with them. That's something that I really look forward to getting back to.
What do you think that COVID has done to your careers as game designers? Has it been good for them? Has it been good for it? Has it been bad for it? Sort of neutral? Because you're just starting out your careers as well, right?
I feel like it's been pretty neutral. I actually, in May or April, I think I got a slight promotion from, like, I used to do marketing and social media stuff for here, but I always wanted to get into the game design. And so when the opportunity opened up, I actually got a promotion and a little raise, which was nice. So I've been one of like the very few people, I think, who had a relatively good year professionally, which I feel incredibly lucky to be in that position and being able to just take my computer home and keep working. Whereas I have a lot of friends who weren't able to do that and had to apply for CRB and stress and worry about their futures, which has been kind of terrible to watch happen to so many people I care about. I feel incredibly lucky, and I think it's been really neutral to maybe slightly positive for my career, if I had to answer.
Yeah, so how about you, Heather?
Yeah, I similar position with Steven. Like, I feel incredibly grateful to be where I'm at. I lined up my job before COVID was even a household word. And I know a lot of my friends who graduated with me, they're really struggling to find jobs. So I'm very fortunate in that regard. I do think it does have some negativities to the way that, like, I'm being introduced to the studio remotely. I don't know anybody. So it's definitely weird and stressful in that regard. As far as the industry goes, I think that, I mean, there's a lot of downsides to it, but, like, a huge positive, I think, is the move to work from home being more accessible and showing studios that that's something that you can do. I know a lot of studios I've heard have entirely stopped paying leases on their buildings. They're completely remote for the rest of time, or letting people work hybrid schedules of you come in 3 days, then you can stay home for 2 days. And I think that that's a really positive shift for accessibility in our industry. So I think that there's some good things coming out of COVID.
I think that it's probably fairly reasonable to assume that COVID has not been bad for the video game industry, because people are playing a lot more video games and they're like you, they're at home. Is that an accurate assessment of the effects of COVID on the video game industry, would you say?
For the industry, yeah, it's been great for shareholders and executives, but the industry's always struggled with valuing the work developers do and developers themselves. There's been a lot of games that have come out this year that developers have endured a lot of abuse over from the kind of toxic entitled gaming community. And that's never been addressed. Like, if you just look at the stock prices of Amazon, who owns a lot of studios now, Activision, Blizzard, EA, 2K, Ubisoft, like, it's been a great year for them. They're making a bunch of money. But the conditions that games are made under have stayed relatively the same. And I don't think it's an entirely great set of conditions games are made under.
Yeah, can you tell me more about what those conditions are that you're referring to?
It's often called crunch in the video game industry, that because game labor is ununionized, unlike writing for movies or TV and actors and production crews that way, like the production of games is often incredibly labor intensive and often involves long nights, long weeks, working weekends, and there's not a lot of ability on the side of developers to go, hey, I want to see my girlfriend or my kids, and I want to just this to be a 9-to-5, which is what it should be. A lot of unpaid overtime. And nothing about COVID and people buying and playing more games has changed those material conditions for the people making them.
So, Heather, is that your experience of the video game industry as well?
Yeah, I can definitely attest to a lot of what Steven's saying. It's also really weird because I feel like there's a lot of things that are hit and miss in the industry right now. Like, there are some studios that are doing really, really well because everyone's at home, so everyone's buying their games. But there's also studios that weren't able to keep up with the work from home transfer, or that people just are losing income because they've lost jobs to COVID, so they don't have as much money to spend on other things. So, like, it's really weird to see what areas are being inflated and what areas are losing a lot of money right now.
Yeah, I wouldn't imagine, too, that working at home, then you have the freedom of working at home and being in your own space. But how do you handle the where is the boundary between my personal life and my business life? How do you shut off after work?
Yeah, it's definitely hard, especially because I'm someone who likes to be on the computer just for fun. So now it's a problem where I sit on my work computer, which is at the same desk as my personal computer. So there's a lot less boundary to that now, and everything kind of blurs together. So I try my best to spend little time on my personal computer outside of work. Like, I really try to limit that. I also read online that a really good habit to get into is to go for a walk before work and then a walk immediately after. And that's like your fake commute to work, to like trick your brain into thinking it's different. And I find that helps me a lot.
I should try that.
Yeah, it's good.
Well, both places where you are, I mean, Lunenburg has some really, really amazing walks that you can take first thing in the day. And also so does Halifax. So what are your survival tips to get through this and to draw those lines between your personal and your business life, Stephen?
Oh, I haven't really had any. I've been pretty terrible at it, to be honest.
I see you have a cat, though, right?
I do have a cat. I got a cat during quarantine. So he's been helping me get up and do something, like feed him and empty his litter box, other than just sit. I have the work computer and then the good computer, and then I just go to bed.
The best things I try to do are try to isolate your work area from the rest of your house if you can. I know not everyone has the privilege to do that. Go for lots of walks. Just try to make as much of a separation as possible. And make sure, like, my big thing is, like, reach out and check on people still, even if, I mean, that doesn't really help with the separation, but, like, don't be afraid to reach out and ask people how they're doing, because everyone really appreciates that.
That was Heather Cleveland and Stephen Riley, two video game designers in Nova Scotia. You're listening to My Art Wears a Mask, a special Rabble.ca series with emerging artists talking about how they're weathering the COVID storm. Next up, I caught up with my next guest by phone while she was waiting for a train in Churchill, Manitoba, back on November 19th. She'll tell you in a minute what she was doing way up there and why she was waiting for the train to take her back to Toronto. Wait for it. What you're about to hear is an interview with Gabriella Vanden, a freelance director of photography who works in the film industry. Among other things, she was a camera person on the short film Joey, that's getting broadcast premieres on Super Channel Fuse and is starting to hit the festival circuit. Here she is answering that question about why she was talking to me from Churchill.
We're waiting for a train because one of the fun things about Churchill is the only way you can access it is through plane or train. You can't drive into it because it's sort of marshland around. So the sort of cost-effective thing to do if you're going to spend time up here is to drive up and then ship your car by train and then have the vehicle here.
The $100,000 question is, why are you in Churchill?
Well, we're in Churchill because, and like most people who come to Churchill to see polar bears, so many film crews end up in Churchill to film polar bears, whether it's from the BBC to just smaller local productions. But my partner and I, we came up here in 2015, I think, for the first time to work on a student film, sort of about the town and about the polar bears. And we've just kind of gotten obsessed ever since. So we've been working on, mostly him, but I help when I can, to work on a documentary that's sort of exploring the intersection of interaction between the polar bears and humans. Because I think most productions that come up here, they try to get sort of the pristine image of the bears, the way a lot of wildlife programming tends to be focused on animals in their habitats. But often what you don't see is what's behind the camera, which is sort of the media circus that follows them. And it's just interesting to see, too, how the town has turned the bears into a form of revenue for themselves. So it's, you know, the ecotourism that's created kind of takes away the fantasy of seeing the bears sort of untouched in the wild. So we're kind of exploring that aspect of what it's like to live next to animals like this, especially since bears are the largest predator left. So that kind of gives them an interesting angle as well, land predators.
So how long have you been up in Churchill?
For this trip, we've been here since October 13th.
So what has that been like traveling during COVID? What kind of extra challenges did you have that you wouldn't have any other time, would you think?
I think that was a big part of not only monetarily why we wanted to come in our truck rather than fly. I think avoiding flying right now is definitely something that's more on our minds because of COVID. Otherwise, it hasn't affected us too much, other than now that we're in Manitoba, they've gone into code red and have locked down a lot more. So it's completely limited our access to a lot of the human subjects that we were going to talk to. So that's been definitely a challenge. And I think people just being more weary of people coming to visit. Churchill decided they didn't want to close down tourism because it is their main revenue. But definitely it feels like there's more tension trying to do filmmaking, especially documentary filmmaking, with people in this time.
Right. And how was the train trip up? What was happening on the trains in terms of social distancing and safety and everything like that?
The train normally has like a sleeping compartment, and then they have a like dining room and that sort of thing. And all of that was eliminated. So we just had seats that weren't too close to one another. And then for those that would have liked to, the thing with the train is it's 16 hours and it's overnight. So you really want to try to get comfortable because you're hoping to sleep on the train. And so I think for people that would have normally used the bed compartments would have, you know, preferred that to sleeping in a chair for 16 hours. So that makes it a little more difficult. Either way, we would have gone with the economy route of sitting in the chairs anyway, but that definitely was different from last time.
Tell me about your career, and you're a director of photography. But what does that mean? What is a director of photography?
So I think to put it plainly, the director of photography is what it sounds like. You are ahead of a department in a way. So you're the bridge between the crew that is doing the lighting and the rigging and the camera work. You're the bridge between them and the creative side with the director and producers. So it's a lot to juggle, I think. And one thing I think a lot of people forget is that it is very much like a manager's position. You need to have good people skills because you are the leader of a team. So it's not all just, you know, gadgetry and getting to have creative ideas. You're really working with people, and I think that's one of the things I like most about it.
And who have you worked with, and what kinds of productions?
I mean, I'm still earlier in my career, so I'll say I've gotten to work with a lot of really great Toronto, especially women. I'll say I've worked a lot with female directors, which has been really great. Some that are more notable, I think, is Chelsea McMullen. She does really incredible documentary narrative hybrids. So that's been really cool to do that. Because often documentary can be more about following story and less about aesthetics, but she really combines the two, which is nice. I got really lucky when I first graduated from York University to be the B camera unit on a CBC show that was about Canadian artists that were getting international recognition. So I got to travel all over the world with that show, which was really, really wonderful, and work with other DPs that were really cool and really good at their jobs, like Maya Bankovich. And then I've been doing a lot of short films lately with directors like Jessica Hinkson and Jessica Harris. And I just did a short with Lauren Grant, who's a wonderful producer in Toronto, and it was her directorial debut, so that was really exciting. But yeah, a lot of LGBTQ stories and female identifying driven stories, which has been really nice because I'm a female identifying person, and it's nice to work in those realms. Not to say that I don't like working with men as well, and I, you know, I enjoy that just as much, but it's nice to be able to bring a perspective to a story that you align with.
Right. So do you work mostly, is it on a freelance basis and you hire yourself out to different directors?
Yes, exactly. I'm freelance, so I'm not with any one company or any one director, which is really nice to have the freedom to work on the types of projects that I feel like working on and to bounce around between the documentary world and the narrative world. So yeah, I really like that.
Yeah. So think back now to last March as the COVID shutdowns were starting to ramp up. Like, what was your life like at that point?
When COVID was ramping up, I was actually shooting a feature film. It was my first feature film, a narrative. They changed the name. It's now On the Fringe of Wild, and it's an LGBTQ story. And we were shooting up in North Bay. So we felt sort of, you know, in our own bubble in a way. But we got really lucky because we wrapped just in time to get home to Toronto for the lockdown to be set in place. So our timing was like, couldn't have been closer. But I think, you know, when COVID first happened, it was really discouraging because I felt on kind of a high, you know, wrapping this feature film, and I loved working with the crew, and I got to be creative. And so that felt so good. And then it felt like I don't know now when that kind of project's going to happen again because of all of that uncertainty that set in. And that was really scary.
Yeah. So then after the COVID lockdown first happened, how many months was it before you had any work again? Or did it continue to kind of dribble in?
Yeah. So, I mean, right before I started shooting the feature, I got called by Vivek Shreya. She wanted to commission me to make, not only shoot, but also direct a short film to accompany her latest novel. So when I got back and lockdown happened, we kind of had some discussions about, you know, how are we going to go about this? We decided to just, you know, work on the creative side and discuss what we were going to do, but not make any real plans yet, since we were in full lockdown. And we just waited until things started to lift a little bit. And I thought about ways that I could shoot while in lockdown. And the project lent itself to that, luckily, because there is sort of an internet component of the book. It's called The Subtweet. So a lot of things happen over Twitter and things like that. I shot what I could in lockdown, and then the only sort of actor we had in person shot in Hyde Park. So it was outside and it was safe, and it was a very limited crew, mostly with my partner who I was already living with in a bubble. So that was really wonderful. And I think it helped me feel hopeful through all of that and kept my creative juices going. But I tried to embrace the stillness and the quiet of the lockdown, because I think too, oftentimes we think like, oh, creative people have to be, you know, pumping stuff out all the time. And that's actually limiting to creativity. So I ended up finding it sort of a really nice kind of incubation to quiet my mind and then be able to go back to being creative.
What other things did you do with your camera that allowed you to explore your creativity and work on your projects, but not have to go into a traditional shooting situation?
I have a bit of an experimental background at when I went to York University, that's what I focused on because I felt it would be best, since I wanted to focus on cinematography, to play around with things. So I got an old Panasonic DVX-1000, and I used that, and I just went around the neighborhood filming. And it's a great camera, but it's DV tape, so it's, you know, older technology. It has its own look, which I found really fun. I happened to have a puppy at the time when lockdown set in, so I spent a lot of time filming my puppy and going on walks and filming sort of the flowers blossoming and just kind of use it as a meditative time. You know, there'd be thunderstorms, and I'd film those with the DVX camera, thinking that I might use it for Vivek's film, but not necessarily needing to. I think it was just a way of working through images and deciding in that way how to condense the visual aesthetic of the film. So sometimes it's nice to just do that work that doesn't have to go anywhere, but you're just creating images. So that was one way I did that. And then I love webcam, like the way webcams look. I think probably because of my age, I grew up, you know, as a preteen, you know, using my webcam to take pictures of me and my sister, stuff like that. So there's a portion in the book where one of the characters uploads a webcam video of herself performing a cover song. And that's a big sort of catalyst for what happens next in the book. We filmed with two sisters who make up a music group called Cartel Madras. They're super cool. And one of them was in Calgary. So I just had her perform the song, lip sing it on her webcam. I had her do it with her laptop and then also with her camera so that it would be a higher resolution so we'd have the options. And then I just give notes, and so she did several performances. And we actually went with the webcam version of it. So it worked out really well. I just told her how I wanted her to decorate her room. We did it all remotely, and it worked out really well.
Fascinating. When is that production coming out?
That is already out. It's on my website. So you can see it there. Vivek shared it as well. So it's a really nice accompaniment to anyone who's a fan of the book. They can watch it. Then the fun thing about the book as well is Vivek is a multidisciplinary artist. So she created an entire album to go along with the book because it is about musicians. So there's sort of this, you know, all this other artwork to go along with it. So as a reader, you get to enjoy these other art forms.
What about sort of keeping afloat economically? What did you do to live if you weren't getting any contracts?
Yeah, so luckily I'm super grateful for the government that we have and was able to collect CERB when it was coming out. So that was super helpful, and that's mostly what I did, and just, you know, try to be economical with food. Luckily, saving wasn't that difficult because we weren't going out, we weren't driving, we weren't spending money on gas. And the project with Vivek helped as well because she did have a grant for that and paid me for that. But I mean, it's not, you know, I don't have as much money now as I think I would have if the lockdown didn't happen. But I have to say, I'm very grateful for that. I'm South American background. My father's Venezuelan, so I have a lot of family in South America that have been struggling because their governments haven't been able to provide in that way. So I'm often grateful for the opportunities and security that I have in Canada.
And how did the reentry back into the world of work, how did that happen? Like, did you just start getting more calls as people, you know, as things started easing up, or did it take longer?
You know what? So it really all kind of came at once, it felt like. I did the project with Vivek, and then because I worked with Cartel Madras for that, they decided that music... Okay, so what I'll say is music really helped to bring film back because a lot of these artists that had been, you know, planning for tours, those got shut down. So they were receiving little grants to make music videos for these sort of virtual festivals. So I made a music video with Cartel Madras, and then I worked with Lito Pimienta as well. She had a bunch of things that were happening for her in lieu of touring. So it really felt like musicians who were suffering sort of in the same way that us film people felt that we were suffering, we got to kind of come together and make stuff. And the nice thing about music videos is they can be either really big or really small. So depending on what the subject is or what the themes are. So luckily we just kept things really small and, you know, did our best to be safe. That felt like that was the gateway back into working again.
Right. And so is there lots of film work out there still, pandemic notwithstanding?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I'm working on my next project is a feature film. We're adapting a theater show into a film because theater is another world where it can't be happening since it's people gathering. And we tried to rent some lights and they're all like whites is out of lights. All of my friends who are technicians that I try to hire on stuff, they're all so busy. I think there's a backlog of productions that were meant to happen when lockdown happened. And normally things start to, in film, there's a bit of a rhythm. You know, summers are really busy and winters start to get less busy. And often you have to plan for the winter that you probably won't be working. But now it seems like that's not happening. It seems lockdown's probably happening. If lockdown wasn't happening, I know a lot of the Christmas movies or straight to television films are going on. All the big union stuff is going on, lots of commercials. So it seems like all of my colleagues are quite busy.
So now looking back from last March until now, what would you say that you have lost and what have you gained through this whole experience of working under lockdown?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I've actually gained a lot. And I'm not trying to sound too positive about the pandemic because I know, you know, a lot of people have been terribly affected. It's been really difficult. I have an elderly grandmother who I wish I could visit, but I can't. But I feel as though I've gained quite a bit because in a way, it feels like having that time where we were all sort of separate, it feels like there's a lot of support, especially for young women of color like me right now coming out of the pandemic. So I've felt like there's been support and work for me. And I did appreciate that time that was spent to just be introspective, to focus on my health. I think with being a freelancer, it's very easy to put your health and your emotional needs aside because you have this drive to be working all of the time because you don't know when you're going to get work again. And so the pandemic made me realize that I had been working so hard and not always putting my health first. So that was kind of an eye-opener. I took a lot of time to just eat well and exercises and yoga and meditation and things that I didn't always have time to do before. And so in a way, I was really upset when it first happened, but looking back, I'm actually kind of grateful for that time to have been focused on things that feel important in that way that I didn't put importance on. But I mean, of course, there was jobs that were going to happen that didn't get to happen. And, you know, I don't have as much money as I think I would have had if it hadn't happened, but I'm okay with that. I just mostly hope that those who have lost loved ones feel for them.
Yeah, that's the hard thing about it, for sure.
Yeah, I don't know if it's hard to talk about. Like, I don't think I'm being super clear, but you kind of go back and forth on how you're feeling in this time. Sometimes it's very lonely, and sometimes I think, people are maybe more compassionate now. Maybe there's a feeling of togetherness that we're all going through this, and I do kind of try to see the positive things that are coming out of it, and I think that's one of them.
That was Gabriella Vanden, a Toronto-based director of photography who was talking to me on November 19th from Churchill, Manitoba. Thanks to all of the artists who have talked to me over these past few weeks. All of the artists saw a lot of good things about the time happening. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm David Suzuki, and you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Information to grow the brain.
Make sure my levels are at around 8.
CKUT 90.3 FM.
Blah, blah, blah. It's
kind of a tongue twister.
Am I popping my peas?
CKUT 90.3 FM.
Start again.
Oh, should I do that? Okay.
I need a script.
CKUT 90.3 FM.
So, you want me to go through it again and actually say that?
This sounds so repetitive.
See, now I can't do it. Once more, okay.
CKUT 90.3 FM.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Wait, do you want me to say hello?
I'll have to do another one.
Yeah, maybe one last one.
Radio CKUT 90.3 FM.
Are you recording? You are? Oh. Can you press stop?
The Sleepy King starts now.